Welcome back to the Medicinal Herbs podcast series from Holistic Matters. Today, naturopathic clinician Angela Highwood returns to the show to talk with our host, Sarah Lebrun-Blaschka, about thyroid health and herbal approaches to supporting this aspect of human physiology.
Well, I'm excited to have Angela back today to talk about our thyroid, how it works, what are some of the conditions that we should be aware of as healthcare providers, and you know, how can we make it healthy, and what are those herbs and foods that really have the opportunity to do that? So welcome, Angela. Thanks for joining me again. It's always wonderful to have you on the podcast. We're always excited to have really great sharing of information.
Oh, thanks for having me again. I love being a part of Holistic Matters.
So today we're going to talk about thyroid, as I said. So can you tell us about the cascade of thyroid hormones and just how the thyroid works?
Yes, sure thing. It's really important, I think, to give our patients a really thorough understanding of exactly how the thyroid hormone cascade works. And when I sit down with my patients and explain the way that the thyroid actually functions, it's often the first time that they've had that education, even if they've had a thyroid condition for, you know, many, many years. You know, very rarely someone sits down and just explains the intricacies of the thyroid. So first things first is our glands in our brain, the hypothalamus and pituitary, are the maestros of the symphony of hormones of the human body. So our hypothalamus releases a hormone called thyrotropin-releasing hormone, which then talks to the pituitary and triggers the pituitary to produce thyroid-stimulating hormone. Most people are under the misconception this is the main thyroid hormone per se. Well, it's actually not. This is produced by the pituitary to then speak to the thyroid and tell the thyroid how much active hormone to produce. So the thyroid stimulating hormone triggers the thyroid gland, the butterfly-shaped gland in our throat, to produce the major hormone T4. And it's called T4 because it's a protein hormone, and the major protein is tyrosine, which is bound to four iodine atoms. So IRS, remember, T4 is tyrosine protein bound to four iodine atoms, of course, using a lot of zinc and a lot of enzymes to bind those molecules together. And T4 is produced exclusively by the thyroid gland, and then has to convert into the active hormone, which is T3. So a snapshot is T4 is actually biologically inactive until it's converted into T3, which is a biologically active form of the hormone. T4 is released out into the bloodstream. And only 10% of the conversion of T4 to T3 actually happens in the thyroid gland itself. 90% of the conversion of T4 to T3, so inactive to active, actually happens in what we call peripheral conversion, which is in other tissue in our body, such as our brain, our bones, our liver. Our liver is a really big player in thyroid hormone conversion and in other peripheral tissue. But really, the liver is something that we'll talk about and focus on a little bit later as well. So in order to convert the T4 to T3, inactive to active, we need an enzyme. And this enzyme is called IDI. It's a selenoprotein enzyme, so requires, again, selenium, healthy fats, and also zinc in order to produce an abundant amount of that enzyme. So you're starting to see here that, you know, we're requiring a fair bit of good functional nutrition just for the thyroid hormone pathway to work well. So T3 is actually converted and active when we break off one of the iodine atoms, and that makes the molecule biologically active to then bind to receptor sites and evoke a response at a cellular level. T3 requires D vitamins to then lock onto receptor sites in the cell, and then actually requires the locking on with iron inside the cell, T3 intracellularly, to then bind to the receptor sites on the mitochondria and the nucleus of every single cell in the human body to then ensure that cellular function and cellular replication and cellular repair and cellular energy and metabolism is really efficient. That's the cascade of the thyroid hormones. There's a couple of other players in this story, and that is our liver. Our liver produces thyroid binding globulin, which is a globulin that can bind to T4 and T3 to make them inactive, and therefore they can go through what we call second pass metabolism and be then available for the body to use after they've gone through a pass through the liver. And again, the liver is a huge player in this story because the liver, especially in phase two metabolism, is responsible for a huge percentage of that conversion to T4 to T3. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. So that's the thyroid hormone symphony, or the thyroid hormone cascade, which is incredibly interesting. And as we can see, you know, I've talked about the necessitation of, you know, a lot of just base functional minerals, iodine, zinc, selenium, and of course the amino acid tyrosine, and essential fats such as cholesterol, which is a building block for every single hormone in the human body. And this is why when we see thyroid hormones start to become a little funky and a little out of balance, one of the first signs we'll see on blood testing is that the cholesterol starts to elevate. Now, that's always a red flag for checking in with the thyroid, but also checking in with other sex hormones. As sex hormones start to get low or thyroid hormones start to get deficient, you'll see cholesterol elevate.
That's really fascinating, this, you know, kind of elevation of certain components like cholesterol, which is such a key, right, as you described, driver of all hormones. It's kind of the basis for that, specifically testosterone. You know, I want to circle back a little bit because I think most people in the general public don't think of your liver as a key component to thyroid health. And so could you go dive a little bit deeper into that? Because I don't think most people understand that connection as well.
Oh, absolutely. And this is something that I'm really passionate about talking about and really bringing home to my patients about how critical it is for their thyroid hormone metabolism to really look after their liver health. So our liver has two stages of metabolic function. It's phase one metabolism and phase two metabolism. You can see that I'm actively avoiding the word detoxification here because detox is one of the words I like to love in a lot of ways because it misconstrues perceptions about the liver's job. So we have phase one liver metabolism, which starts to conjugate toxins and hormones, et cetera, in the body. And then that pushes them through to phase two conjugation, which then changes that chemical, the hormone or the toxin or whatever, in order to then make it safe to pass through the liver for either excretion or second pass in the body. Now, there's five pathways of phase two liver metabolism, and glucuronidation and sulfation are two of the five paths, but these are the two paths that are most responsible for the conversion of the T4 hormone to T3. So if we don't have the basic building blocks in our liver, bioavailable for our liver to do the job of sulfation and glucuronidation really efficiently, then we're not going to get the optimal conversion of the inactive T4 over to the active T4 hormone. Therefore, it's going to interfere with our thyroid hormone efficiency. And this is whether it's your own endogenous hormone or the big one, is if a patient is on synthetic thyroid hormones or even the, you know, what we call natural thyroid hormones, like thyroxine or oroxine or nature thyroid, etc., we still need really good phase two liver metabolism in order to actually make those exogenous hormones effective in our body. So it's critically important we refocus on upregulating phase two liver metabolism, and we do that with providing the body with really good levels of amino acids, a really dense supply of great minerals, lots of whole food sources of sulfur, the natural sulfuraphane coming from brassica vegetable families, all of our broccoli, asparagus, Brussels sprouts, Asian green vegetables like choy sum, bok choy, radishes, daikon, etc. They are such incredible functional foods for upregulating phase two liver metabolism and therefore playing a very important role in boosting our liver's ability to convert T4 to the active thyroid hormone T3. So that's why it's so critically important to really focus on the liver and ensure that the liver's functioning so well.
So you talked just right now about T3. Can you explain a little bit more about the relevance of it? And why wouldn't it be important if we're suspecting a thyroid problem to have somebody tested for a concern around their level of reverse T3?
Okay, so T3, in a nutshell, is our active thyroid hormone. Really, it's only the T3 that will determine how good our mitochondria are going to function from a metabolics point of view. And we need sufficient intracellular T3 in order to really have good DNA replication, which is, you know, cell repair and also reproduction for that matter. That's why thyroid hormone health is so critical for the fertility years as well. Now, what I find is a lot of time patients, doctors aren't testing anything other than the thyroid stimulating hormone, and they're ignoring levels of T4 or T3, which is it's wrong. We can't do that. We need to actually know how every part of the thyroid hormone cascade is going. We've got to test for free T3. We've got to test for free T4. And it's critically important to also test for something called reverse T3. Now, reverse T3 is an inactive form of T3. That is produced by the body in particular times like stress, for example. So reverse T3 can be a real problem. And unless you test for it, you won't know if it's playing a part in making an underactive thyroid more complicated. Okay, so when we convert T4 to T3, this is a stage where T4 can be mistakenly produced into reverse T3. And as I said, reverse T3 can bind onto receptor sites of T3 in our cells and in our mitochondria and in our nucleus, but essentially blocks up that receptor site and makes it inactive. So if the receptor sites are, you know, blocked up with lots of reverse T3, then the T3 itself can't bind to that site and exert an effect. So this can compound or make worse the symptoms of hypothyroidism and, you know, more T4 hormone, for example, which is what sort of, you know, a primary medical person might do in that situation, is certainly not going to make the situation any better, for example. I can't tell you how many times I've seen, you know, patients, doctors, and they're only doing what they're trained to do, but just prescribe more and more T4 hormone when they're, you know, the patient's exhibiting more and more signs of hypothyroidism. So now it isn't normal to have an excessive amount of reverse T3 in the body. So here's some of the factors that can trigger the production of reverse T3. The big one that has a lot of evidence bases is good old-fashioned stress. So stress is really what we're talking about, the hormone cortisol. And when a patient has a lot of cortisol pumping through their veins, it encourages then the conversion of T4 into reverse T3. So the type of strategies I use for that is botanical adaptogens. Botanical adaptogens are our key drivers to reduce biological stress and the impact of biological stress and reduce elevated cortisol. The most powerful adaptogen of them all to reduce elevated cortisol is the beautiful ashwagandha or Withania somnifera. But in this case, I always reach to echinacea and one of my other favourites for this circumstance is rhodiola as well, because rhodiola is so fantastic at helping to overcome the fatigue associated with hypothyroidism. at the same time as mitigating. So stress is one factor. Now, poor blood sugar management or insulin regulation is also a factor that can trigger more reverse T3 production. So here's where I will check fasting insulin and check blood glucose regulation. For a healthy thyroid, it's really important to pretty much go like a paleo approach to diet and really lock down blood sugar levels. But botanically, to regulate blood sugar and therefore support the thyroid, I'm reaching for herbs like nigella or the holy black seed, as it's otherwise referred to. Also cinnamon, gymnema. These are three core blood glucose regulators that really have a great benefit for someone with an underactive thyroid if they're producing lots of reverse T3. Now, it's no surprises to speculate that biological inflammation really messes up the thyroid hormone cascade, and inflammatory mediators like elevated ESR and elevated CRP and elevated interleukins have been associated with more reverse T3 production. So again, we're thinking of botanical remedies like turmeric, saffron, green tea, rosemary, resveratrol, and all the herbs that fall into the NRF2 upregulated category. And NRF2 is really just a fancy new terminology for superpower antioxidant plants. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that's very interesting to see is that, and there's a good body of research around this, to show that starvation or crash dieting or eating disorders also dramatically increase your reverse T3 production. Now, this makes so much sense from a biological point of view, because anytime the human body is put into starvation, it goes into survival and conservation mode. So the body produces a heap of reverse T3 in order to stop muscle wasting and stop fat being actually metabolically used as a source of energy. So it's really important, again, that we can use elevated reverse T3 to talk to patients about, well, how many calories are you consuming? Have you been doing any funky diets? How much weight have you lost? Or sometimes I've, actually seen this and unraveled some eating disorders in patients. So it's just an interesting sort of food for thought there. Now, we also know that certain nutritional deficiencies, low zinc, low selenium, low B vitamins can also trigger more reverse T3 production, especially when paired with some heavy metal toxicity. So hopefully that gives you a bit of a checklist of things to be thinking about if you find patients coming back with a high reverse T3.
What do you feel is the prevalence of thyroid concerns? It's interesting, over the last year, I personally run into more people who have either elevated thyroid, and maybe it's because of what's going on in the world, or even those who maybe have, non-cancerous, growths too. So it seems like it's just becoming much more prevalent.
Absolutely right. I mean, it feels like every second or third patient that walks through my, office door has some degree of thyroid problem. So yes, the prevalence is astronomical. And I'd go so far as to say, I think, thyroxine or oroxine, the T4 synthetic hormone, is probably one of the top 20 prescribed drugs around the world. So according to the American Thyroid Association, which have got some fantastic statistics on their website, I use them as a great source of information all the time, they say that it's approximately 12% of the US population is likely to develop a thyroid condition during their lifetime. So that's an estimated 20 million Americans having some form of thyroid disease. Now, I might like to just clarify here, that's diagnosed thyroid disorders. We can probably estimate that there's a huge percentage of the population that fall into the subclinical category here, which don't fall into this statistic. So I'd say there's at least another, 10 or 20% of the population that are walking around either undiagnosed or in that subclinical underactive thyroid or subclinical overactive thyroid or thyroid storm. So the prevalence is really high. We always need to be checking it really thoroughly in our symptom screening and if you do any pathology testing for your patients to be ensured that we're testing it thoroughly, or asking their primary healthcare physician to be checking it thoroughly as well. So it's really, really common. And I think that in this modern era, given that we live in a sea of environmental toxicity, given that we live in an absolute storm of stress these days, it's not very hard to wonder why the thyroid is collapsing from underneath us. So environmental toxicities play an incredible role in, inducing thyroid disorder.
We've talked about, you know, the different risk factors. Is there other risk factors that you would want to bring forward too? And then if we know we have those risk factors, how do we make sure that we stay healthy, keep our thyroid as healthy as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So unfortunately, simply being a woman increases your risk of thyroid disorders. And that's because of the interplay of estrogen and our thyroid hormones. Estrogen dominance can also play a role in triggering more reverse T3 production, and our ovaries will more exclusively sort of use our zinc, for example, leaving less left for thyroid hormone metabolism. So known risk factors include being a woman and being over the age of 60 puts you at high risk of thyroid problems. What we need to be doing is always looking after our female hormone metabolism, and, of course, ensuring that we have a mineral and amino acid-rich diet so we mitigate some of the risks. Now, I also want to get back to talking about our lovely liver and making sure that we really take care of our liver's ability to, you know, run beautiful phase one and phase two pathways so that we can metabolize our hormones properly and also detoxify environmental toxins really efficiently. So that's number one. If you have a pre-existing autoimmune condition such as celiac disease or type 1 diabetes, that gives you a higher predisposition to a thyroid disorder as well, especially Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So we need to take care of the immune system. One of my favourite adaptogens for the human body that's also a very famous immune herb is echinacea. So if we have a pre-existing autoimmune condition, we might like to factor in the daily use of echinacea to help our stress levels. Echinacea is the classic adrenal adaptogen, and also to look after our immune system more efficiently. We can also look at some of the medicinal mushrooms there, the reishi and shiitake, are very, very powerful and well-researched for what we call TH1 to TH2 regulation, which is really quietening down the autoimmune diseases. So, you know, they can be classed as foods or herbs, really, whatever you like to call them. They're very good for the immune system. We need to also look after the pituitary. So pituitary gland disorders give a higher risk of then a secondary thyroid disorder. So the pituitary relies on lots of zinc to keep it healthy, so that's easily enough achieved. Women who are pregnant have a higher risk of thyroid disorders. So the thyroid can get really shaky in the third trimester and also the fourth trimester, that really critical 3 months postpartum. So it's very important to make sure she has a dense amount of nutrition available to her, plenty of amino acids, plenty of minerals. And in pregnancy, I feel like it's particularly important to really look after the immune system, because pregnancy naturally immune compromises a woman. So her immune system recognises the baby as, you know, a baby and not something that's foreign and hostile. So, again, in pregnancy, echinacea is category A safety in pregnancy. It's really safe and really lovely. And, of course, we can use lots of beautiful immune-enhancing minerals like zinc and iodine and selenium and vitamin C and bioflavonoids. We talked a lot today already about stress and the impact of stress on thyroid. So, again, really important to look after our adrenals and our nervous system, which is exercise, it's sufficient sleep, it's mindfulness, And then we can layer in the beautiful botanical adaptogens. Particularly my favorite here is ashwagandha. We need beautiful nutrition and we need to avoid obvious environmental toxicities, which is, you know, plastics and pesticides and herbicides. So I think it's incredibly important, but especially for thyroid patients, to be living as low tox of a life as possible. And I always point my patients in the direction of a fantastic American resource, which is the Environmental Working Group. That website is a real global authority on environmental toxins and practical approaches of what to do about it, how to be aware of them, and how to make some sensible choices to avoid them. So I hope that little checklist has been sort of helpful for you.
Yeah, that's very helpful. You know, I think we focused a lot on women. Do men also need to think about how they take care of their thyroid?
Absolutely. What's the number one mineral men's bodies need? It's zinc.
Right.
So zinc.
For many reasons, right?
For many reasons. Yeah, absolutely. So it's critically important we take care of men's thyroid hormone metabolism because zinc has such high demand for male reproductive function. And often can be one of the most depleted minerals globally in the human body. So just because we have a male patient, we can't not be thorough in our approaches to checking the possible involvement of thyroid hormones.
I think that's important to think about too, because we do so think about it in women, and sometimes it may be an issue in the men that we're seeing too. So let's dive a little bit deeper into what type of botanical medicine we can use to help support thyroid health. You touched on a few herbs, such as ashwagandha, but can you dive a little bit deeper and give us some insights?
Absolutely. So I'm going to give you a list of sort of five or six of my top plant medicines for optimal thyroid health. And my number one on that list is ashwagandha. Ashwagandha is, other than being an adrenal adaptogen and reducing the impacts of cortisol, which is a critically important strategy, ashwagandha has independent research to show that it's actually a thyroid tonic in its own right and really supports the conversion of T4 to T3 in the thyroid gland itself. So it's traditionally known in plant medicine as a thyroid tonic, in addition to the fact that it reduces the impacts of stress and the then dire consequences of stress on thyroid hormone metabolism. So ashwagandha is without fail the first herb that I will always go to. Another is bladderwrack, and bladderwrack should not be confused with deep sea kelp. Bladderwrack is a shore-dwelling species of seaweed that would have been able to be traditionally harvested from the beaches, for people who lived in the coastal areas, and then used as whole food medicine. Every single culture has the tradition of using some sort of like seaweed or sea vegetables, like, you know, seaweeds or dulse or the likes, which are the Mother Nature's natural and most powerful sources of iodine. So bladderwrack has twofold benefit. It's a beautiful source of a protein-bound iodine, making it safer than a mineral-bound iodine from beautiful natural whole food ocean sources. But also there's other phytochemicals in bladderwrack that are known to be heavy metal chelators. So at the same time as donating iodine, it helps the body clean up, you know, toxicity from like lead, mercury and cadmium. So a really beautiful plant. One of my other favourites is bacopa, otherwise known as Brahmi. Bacopa, again, has independent research to show that it's a thyroid gland tonic, so specific action on the thyroid, but also it's known as a brain tonic. One of the biggest symptoms of underactive thyroid is brain fog, confusion, cognitive fatigue, and bacopa is just so famous as a herb for being incredible for making the brain feel sparkly and fresh again. Nettles, good old stinging nettles, is a beautiful plant for the thyroid. And predominantly because it's one of the most glorious whole food sources of minerals. I call nettles the multi-mineral of the botanical kingdom. Nettles is also rich in iron, and iron's really important from an intracellular perspective to bind with T3 to actually then act on the mitochondria and the nucleus. So by taking nettles just in whole food, you can throw it into food, you can make a tea from it. It donates beautiful amount of minerals, including the important iron. Then we've talked about, you know, the relevance of liver support and really supporting phase two liver metabolism. And there's a couple of really famous herbs for doing that: turmeric, rosemary, and Schisandra. These are all known to upregulate the five metabolic pathways of phase two liver metabolism. And then I'd be very remiss if I didn't mention something called sulforaphane, which is donated to us in our diet through predominantly brassica vegetables. And sulforaphane is so critically important for phase two liver metabolism, so for detoxification of environmental chemicals, for detoxification of like hormones like estrogen, for example, and also for supporting the conversion of T4 to T3 via the liver pathways. So brassica vegetables, we need to start to consider them like a herb, like a medicine. And thankfully, they're readily available to us, you know, in our whole food world. So there's some of the plant medicines that I reach to first and foremost for particularly underactive thyroid.
I think all of those are just so beautiful. And I love the idea of the brassicas and thinking of it more as almost it's the way you think of herbs. And so, but you know, sometimes people get mixed messages, maybe, you know, as they're reading something on the internet about the brassicas. And if they're concerned with their thyroid as a goitrogen, can you talk a little bit more about that and kind of general thoughts on that specific concern that may be out there in popular public?
Oh my goodness. People, my patients come and say to me, oh, I can't eat broccoli. I have a thyroid problem. Oh, I can't eat kale. I have a thyroid problem. And I say to them, Oh, well, let me give you the correct information. Now, so the whole landmine, as I like to call it, of the brassica vegetables and the goitrogenic effect. Now, number one, and this I'm going to quote some published research for you here. I'm a bit of a research nerd. I love a good clinical study and a clinical paper. So this paper published in 2020, it says cruciferous vegetables are of the brassica family, including kale, turnip, cauliflower, broccoli, asparagus, etc., rich in a goitrogen called thiocyanate, but inhibits iodine uptake from the thyroid cell. Now, what it says is here is all the research is actually animal studies, not human studies. Now, the animals that these studies were done on is grazing animals such as sheep, for example, who only eat plants on the pastures. So they're, you know, 100% plant-eating animals. And they, of course, only consume them raw because they don't cook them up. They graze them as Mother Nature provides them. So this clinical study says, there is not enough data available for humans to define what would be an overdose amount of cruciferous vegetable consumption in order to cause thyroid dysfunction. So they're saying that you would essentially need to consume like an awful lot of pure kale juice, raw pure kale juice consistently for longer than, you know, 28 days. So every day having up to about a litre of kale juice in addition to, a kilo to a kilo and a half of raw bok choy to have any negative thyroid impact. And to be honest with you, I don't know anyone doing that. People are cooking the brassica vegetables. Mm-hmm. And the clinical study says heating or cooking is known as a beneficial way to denature the goitrogenic compounds to therefore render brassica vegetables to be non-harmful to the thyroid. So the takeout message here is the benefits of the sulforaphanes in the brassica vegetables for thyroid health and liver health far outweigh the lack of human data that might suggest that the thiocyanates found in raw brassicas could have a negative thyroid impact. So when in doubt, just cook them. Now, cooking them is no more than lightly steaming them, which is generally the way that humans would consume those brassica vegetables. If you like a really good coleslaw and you want to have some, you know, raw cabbage or some raw kale in a salad, go for it. You know, it's unlikely that you're going to be consuming, you know, more than a kilo to a kilo and a half of raw brassicas every day on a consistent basis to then negatively impact thyroid function. Mm-hmm. So I say to my patients, I really want you to have a diet rich in brassica vegetables, and when in doubt, just lightly steam them, stir fry them, saute them, make them into soups, and you still get all the benefits without any of the worries.
I love that. Who doesn't love some nice, you know, lightly steamed broccoli, and know that you're doing good things for your liver as you're consuming it? Iodine is something, obviously, we didn't really talk too much about, but of course, it's something that many people consider as an essential part of thyroid health.
Absolutely. Look, iodine is something that we always need to be very careful of, to be perfectly honest.
Right.
I know that there's a huge movement in the natural medicine world of giving really robust doses of iodine for thyroid hormone conditions. However, I would caution you, caution against that, because unfortunately I have seen excess iodine consumption mm-hmm. tip over to overactive thyroid and the development of thyroid antibodies and Graves. So I always say there is no need to rush. We can give a nice repletion dose of, you know, maybe 300 or 400 or 500 micrograms mm-hmm. per day and do it over 3 to 4 months and then remeasure their spot urinary iodine or their 24-hour urinary iodine to see where things are at. So I just like to say with iodine, yes, it is an incredibly important mineral for thyroid hormone health. However, go slow, go low, and consistently measure iodine in urine and consistently measure thyroid antibodies. If a patient is positive for thyroid antibodies and has autoimmune complications such as Hashimoto's, then I even go more slowly and mm-hmm. more low so that I can very carefully monitor and not tip them over the edge. So I'm very careful with iodine and I'm very conservative with iodine because I feel that there's no need to rush. We can give them nice, gentle doses and slowly replete them safely over the course of time.
I think that's a very wise and way to approach iodine. So I appreciate those comments. If I take all of what you said, which was, you know, such a rich information in regards to thyroid health, you know, eating a good diet, understanding your stress, knowing if you're at risk, and then utilizing some of these beautiful herbs that you were talking about, you know, from ashwagandha and on. And, you know, personally, I mean, as I said, I love the brassica vegetables and I love the role of sulforaphane and making sure that we chew it so that we get our myrcinase to engage in it and make it active. And I just want to give you the last words then. You know, what should we be doing? What would be those key takeaways for thyroid health?
Okay, sleep well. Okay, sleep is something that helps us manage stress and mitigate elevated cortisol the next day. So it's critically important for human health and well-being and thyroid health and well-being to be very mindful of our sleep quality, our sleep quantity, and our sleep hygiene. Number two is exercise well. We know that exercise supports healthy thyroid hormone metabolism. So, and I always say to people, so what type of exercise should I be doing and how much should I be doing? My take on exercise is do whatever brings you joy, okay? Do whatever you love to do. If that's running, great. If that's swimming, wonderful. If that's doing some yoga or even just a simple walk, that's perfectly fine as well. But as long as we're moving our body every day, that's critically important. We need to eat well. I've given you some strategies today to eat well, a focus on more of a paleo approach to diet, a nice amount of healthy fats in the diet, and an abundance of brassica vegetables in the diet. That's optimization of thyroid health and metabolism right there. If a patient is Hashimoto's or has thyroid antibodies, then I always say go gluten-free, go dairy-free. There's enough evidence now to support gluten-free, dairy-free for reduction of thyroid autoimmune disease. So we're sleeping well, we're exercising well, we're eating well. And I think the fourth most important part of the strategy is be mindful of environmental toxicity. So live clean, be mindful of the food groups like the clean 15 and the dirty dozen. Be mindful of environmental plastics and be mindful of any pharmaceutical drugs that it can impact thyroid health. So again, check out the Environmental Working Group. They've got an amazing resource available freely to us all there to help us learn more about that. And then the most other important thing is mitigate stress. So let's plug in some stress support from the botanical adaptogenic family in addition to mindfulness practice. Because the more stressed we are, the more deranged not only our endocrine system will become, but our immune system's going to get funky on us with a lot of stress as well. And, you know, yes, we're currently in, you know, an international stress crisis with, but, you know, this is just one thing that's happening to us now. There will be more future stresses coming. So the better we support ourselves, mental, physical, emotional and spiritually, the better we will cope and the better our beautiful bodies will cope through the face of stress as well.
Well, I think that's such an important message of thinking about stress and sleep and the food. And I love the message about exercise as we think about our health in general, but specifically our conversation about thyroid health. So again, Angela, it's always a pleasure to have you. And I really thank you for your time and giving all this great information to our listeners.
Thanks for having me. I always love to chat natural medicine. This is my passion and my joy.
Thank you, Angela and Sarah, for a great conversation on the thyroid hormone symphony and the medicinal herbs that serve as its instruments. Listen to more episodes of the Medicinal Herbs series from holisticmatters.com. That's holistic with a W.